As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Lisa Abramowitz, along with Tom Keene and Jonathan Farrow. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, geopolitics, finance, and investment. Subscribe to Bloomberg Surveillance on demand on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And always on Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.
Right now, I don't want to delay a great conversation coming up. Bloomberg's own Youssef Gamal Eldin is joining us, sitting by with Jennifer Johnson, president and CEO of Franklin Templeton in Riyadh. Let's head over. Youssef, hey.
Hey, Lisa. Yeah, so let's pick up on the big debate on the health of the U.S. economy and a few other angles as well. Jenny, thank you for making the time. So we had Jamie Dimon come out strong. He's saying there should be a lot more humility from central banks. They got all their forecasts wrong. Ray Dalio is pessimistic. I want to know where Jenny Johnson stands in this debate.
Well, I am a little concerned about U.S. debt and its impact on interest rates, right? I mean, I think that the conversation on rates is constantly focused on what Powell's going to do next month. Or December, and I actually think the bigger story is really around, you know, we've got a U.S. debt that has gone from $9 trillion to $31 trillion, and you have to have buyers of that debt, and that means you have to have a rate that's reasonably priced to attract debt, and it potentially crowds out some of the other investment opportunities. So, you know, that's a concern, and you've got a deficit this year that's going to add $2 trillion to the debt. So I think that can weigh on the economy.
And, yeah. And where do you see interest rates going then? I mean, it, 2 weeks ago, you still had the view that there's one more hike in the plan. Do you still stand by that?
I think Powell kind of came out and said probably won't do it in November, but he's watching the data. So I think, you know, maybe he'll do December. I think it'll be data driven. Maybe he'll just kind of leave it for where it is and see how it plays out. I think the bigger story has been around the 10-year, and I think that's more of an issue around the, you know, U.S. debt.
I mean, you've seen the volatility in Treasury yields, yep. And of course some of the, you know, prolific commentators, let me put it that way, including Mr. Ackman and many others. Do you think that we're going to start consolidating now at the current levels? I mean, what's going to bring them down? Because there was a big debate on what's going to carry them up. If they are going to go down from here, where, you know, what's going to push them down?
I mean, honestly, there's a lot of things. You know, I think that the Fed has done a good job on kind of jamming on the brakes and raising rates and slowing things. But, you know, there's tremendous headwinds to slowing inflation. Oil prices are inflationary. You know, some of the union wage negotiations are inflationary. So there's factors that makes it tough. The you know, spending on things like renewable energy, government spending and incentives on renewable energy and things like the CHIPS Act are all pumping money into the system. That becomes a headwind to somebody who's trying to tamp down inflation.
One of the stories that's been trending in the last 24 hours on the terminal is about $600 billion worth of client cash that it's headed for the exits from some of the bigger investment funds. And it raises the question, how does Franklin sort of thrive amid a shift to more passive solutions?
Well, first of all, let me take on
that. Are you going to push this back?
I'm going to push back on the passive-active.
All right.
Okay. Anytime you have a full momentum market where you've literally had central banks printing money, right, and interest rates zero, the only place to go is the equity markets. That pumped the equity markets up. But today, right, and first of all, nobody ever talks about market beta or passive as going up or down in risk. The day Tesla was added to the S&P 500, market beta became more risky, right? And we don't talk about that. Now you're sitting here today, you've got a market where you look at it and say it's up 13%, but actually most of that's because of seven stocks, the Magnificent Seven. You're seeing the highest concentration. You know, at the peak of the dot-com, 10 stocks accounted for 25% of the market cap. Today, that's 30%. So, or 32%, right? So you're even higher from a concentration. It usually doesn't end well after that. And from the return standpoint, top five stocks have a P/E ratio of 49, and the rest of the market has a P/E ratio of like 14. So, you know, those are really different from a risk scenario. Yeah. Now you got to navigate interest rates. You got to figure out the impact of rates on different companies. I think it's a time for action.
Yeah, and that warrants its own debate. I want to get to your meetings here in Saudi Arabia. Talk to me about the opportunity set here and where you could sort of lock in additional growth.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm here at FII, and, you know, one of the reasons to be here is because you can, you know, Franklin Templeton's a global company. We have clients in 160 countries. You come to FII, you can meet your clients from Asia, from the U.S., from Europe, from all Africa, all over the world. And so it's a great place to convene and efficiently meet with clients. But it's also, I mean, I tend to think energy transition, a lot of the innovation is coming out of this region. And I know that sort of sounds counterintuitive, but what you find is a mentality of multiple generations, thinking about how do we position ourselves for generations, and a recognition that at some point oil goes away, we better diversify the economy. And you see initiatives like in Saudi Arabia, where by 2030 they want 50% of their energy coming from renewables. UAE, I think, has said by 2050 they want 50%. Yeah. This is a region that has the will and the capital to actually focus on that innovation.
We're closely monitoring what's happening with the Israel-Gaza conflict. It's a human tragedy in the first instance. In terms of sort of second-round effects, capital markets, to what extent is that going to take away from some of the ambitions that the Gulf has as an investment destination longer term?
Well, first of all, I mean, it's an absolute humanitarian crisis. It is a terrible, terrible situation. It's very difficult to watch it unfold, and it's awful. If it stays contained, it probably won't have longer term impacts other than in obviously tremendous impacts in the areas in both Israel and Gaza. But as long as it remains, you know, contained, then I think it doesn't slow things down. And honestly, I think, you know, places like Saudi and the UAE are actually motivated to try to come up with a resolution because they don't want to derail the progress that they're making on their visions, you know, and trying to attract capital into the region.
So, closing question on broader strategy. You've been acquisitive. What's sort of next on the purchase list? How much are you willing to allocate?
Well, we've been very open about the fact that we think sort of the last area that we'd love to fill is infrastructure. I think the spending on infrastructure, whether it's energy transition or even just updating infrastructure, you know, across the globe, because so many of the developed markets have aged infrastructure, is a great opportunity. So that would probably be the last area that we'd feel we need to complete sort of our product capabilities.
Jenny, great to touch base. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Best of luck with your meetings over the next couple of days. It's Jenny Johnson, the CEO of Franklin Templeton.
Joining me now is Mandeep Singh, Senior Tech Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. It's a relief to see me rather than the other three, isn't it? Aha! Okay, so we're going to get a few more tech results. Part of the Magnificent Seven are going to get delivered today. Talk to me about Google, owner of Alphabet, Google, whatever way round you like to look at it. Are they more immune just simply because I've got to advertise on the platform relative to, let's say, Meta or to Snap? I mean, that's the consensus in the story. Do you believe that?
Yes, and also the divergence in expectations. So Meta is expected to grow 21%, Google 10%. And when you parse through their business segments, you know, the search will likely be resilient. We know they're not losing any share to OpenAI and Bing and YouTube. I mean, that 10% is a low bogey. So you probably should expect some upside there. Cloud, another big segment for them. And
we really used to get very obsessed. Well, not used to get very obsessed, but we are absolutely obsessed. What happens in cloud at Amazon? What happens in cloud with Alphabet? How has that grown and where can that get to and how important is it?
Yeah, so think of the three hyperscalers, Amazon, Microsoft, and Google. That makes up about $180 billion in cloud revenue. And they were growing at north of 30%. This year, the growth has decelerated to about 18 to 20%. So what everyone is looking for, that acceleration next year, because these are the companies that are buying all the NVIDIA GPUs. And if that doesn't translate into real revenue, then we got a problem. But so far, the story has been that hyperscalers will provide the GPU capacity for generative AI, and that's going to reflect in 2024 numbers.
And those hyperscalers are also critically important to Amazon as well, aren't they? And Amazon's going to be a lovely insight into how strong we are or not on the consumer side as well.
Yeah, so Amazon is the largest player in that public cloud, the $180 billion revenue that I mentioned. It's about 45%. Microsoft is the second big player. And in the case of Amazon, everyone is thinking they are behind in that generative AI race, and the other two are ahead. But clearly, you know, they are the largest player in cloud. And if anything, this generative AI wave is going to accelerate that shift to cloud, because you can only do AI training on the cloud. You can't do it on-prem.
Are you going to be on AI word count in this reporting season in Magnificent Seven? I mean, it's all you got to do is print those two letters, and you're off to the races.
Well, now I think the time has come to guide.
Are we going to be more discerning?
And the 2024 guide is very important. So that's where you are going to see companies that actually guide to that lift from GPU revenue on the cloud. That's where you're going to see, you know, the multiples and the estimates go up. But so far, it's been a huge investment year. Everyone is hoping 2024 is when it translates into revenue.
And then if I talk about Microsoft, Microsoft is interesting for all of the aspects that we've just touched on, a little bit of AI, a great deal of cloud, but also for them, there's the hardware side of this as well. Where does Microsoft fit into the Magnificent Seven?
Well, Microsoft clearly had that early OpenAI partnership, and that helped them, you know, in terms of establishing that generative AI leadership. But I think the PC side is still weak, and you are seeing that decline in that Windows revenue. Clearly, that hasn't changed. Everyone is calling for a PC bottom this quarter, but we don't know if that's going to be the case. And
if we slow down next year, it could be that Microsoft takes the bigger hits, perhaps out of this grouping.
Well, so Microsoft has a lot of application software revenue.
Yep.
And if they don't, add those co-pilots to really complement that, and if there is actually real disruption from generative AI, I would argue Microsoft is at risk. But nobody doubts that Office, you know, will continue to be strong because they added these co-pilots, and that will be a nice add-on to, you know, what you already have from the Office suite.
So Europe is under pressure. Technically, we can argue about recession. China, you can debate whether they're going to make 5% growth or not, but it's tough in China at the moment. With those two global markets very much under pressure, who is perhaps the weakest link in the Magnificent Seven, vicariously exposed to the China story?
I mean, I would say Apple. No doubt about it.
I'm just about to buy a new Apple 15.
From a revenue perspective, 20% revenue, and the supply chain exposure is huge. So if there is a big risk that clearly lies with Apple, the other ones are somewhat insulated because they don't have a lot of revenue exposure. And that's where the internet names like Alphabet and Meta, they have no exposure at all. So clearly Apple is the one to watch out for in terms of that geo revenue exposure.
Okay, and then of course we have the friendshoring, onshoring. Let's see what the numbers are when they drop. Thank you so much for stopping by. That is Mandeep Singh on all things technology.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Vanis Krani and Cameron Dawson, CIO at New Edge Wealth, both with us. Right now in markets, we can see a bit of a lift. We do see those earnings coming out. And Cameron, it's just been catching my eye. Everything has been beating.
Yeah, much better than expected. When it's looking at the consumer better than expected, some industrials better than expected. We just got Sherwin-Williams come out. They raised guidance significantly. That's a housing-related stock, right? It's paint, people spending more on their houses. So clearly the consumer in these earnings is holding up better than expected, somewhat confirming that better retail sales that we got in September.
Do you think the whole narrative, the whole story about excess savings running off is we're overplaying it when you look at the wealth report that all three of us looked at yesterday? So do you think the excess savings narrative dropping so aggressively is folly? Should we, you know, the resilience of the consumer is abound in these numbers.
I think that it's a fading tailwind, but okay, it's not a headwind because the consumer balance sheet is healthy. But
the risk is it turns into a headwind in 2024. That's the debate, isn't it?
Certainly, but if you look at things like consumer credit cards as a percentage of disposable income, they're just back to their 2019 levels, meaning that it's gone up a lot. Consumers are using more debt, but it's not nearly where it was during the Great Financial Crisis. So assets have been growing faster than liabilities pretty much consistently for the last 7 years. The consumer balance sheet still is healthy, even though at the margins it's deteriorating.
So there's a real sort of bigger picture question about composition, and we were talking about this with Tom Tsitsouris yesterday when he came on and said what you're seeing is that the Fed policy rates have really affected lower income individuals and smaller businesses disproportionately. You have seen this again and again. So when do they start to have a bigger impact on the overall general narrative, or can you see this dispersion continue where the overall averages keep chugging along?
Well, the thing that lower income individuals and smaller businesses have in common is that they tend to have more of that floating rate debt. It's bigger companies and higher income people who are able to term out their debt, borrow at 30-year mortgages or issue 30-year bonds. And so it's those larger borrowers that have not been pinched by these higher interest rates. It's why small caps and micro caps are underperforming so much. They have more floating rate debt.
But we were just chatting about this in the break. As Gina left, I said, I thought we were supposed to run into some kind of a significant debt cliff moment for corporates, refinancing. They have refinancing. Now, we haven't made a huge deal out of anybody missing the refinancing yet. But as you look at debt costs going forward and you look at the returns going forward with debt costs, surely that begins to impinge as well.
Well, certainly, because eventually you have to refinance that debt. And if you look at the corporate treasury market, a lot, or corporate bond market, a lot of them have average yields that are less than the entirety of the treasury curve. So eventually you will have to refinance at these much higher rates. And that's the reality of higher for longer starting to bite.
This is what everyone thought, okay? And this, to me, I'm so glad you brought this up, Manus, because to me, there's been this sort of overhang. Back in 2015, 2016, we were talking about beer goggles. Dallas Fed President Kaplan came on and said, everyone's looking at this world with beer goggles of low rates, and that's why they're buying anything. Anything can look beautiful when you go out and you take a look at assets with low rates, with zero rates. And now you're expecting Armageddon because you've had a world refinance at that, and you haven't. And that's really sort of the surprise. How much can companies survive by just basically relying on investors to force them to stay afloat so the investors don't get totally slammed with losses, right? I mean, this is something that you've been seeing with helping refinance at decent rates.
I think we're just now starting to see the pinch come through because we've been in this for 18 months, a little, almost 2 years now. That's a loud extend and pretend. You can try to push off the refinancing as much as possible, because remember, we're also conditioned for the Fed to come in and cut rates really quickly. And the Fed's telling you they're not going to do that. So it's the reality setting in that, hey, I've delayed refinancing as long as possible. Now I kind of have to face the music, and the end result is much higher rates.
So how have you shifted your views over the past couple of weeks?
Yeah, so we have been underweight duration for the entirety of the year, thinking that there was this floor under interest rates because of that higher for longer and an upward bias to interest rates. But now we're starting to see a world where the risk reward simply looks better. If you take a 100 basis point move higher in yields versus lower in yields, at least you have this higher base yield offsetting some of those losses. So when we think for long-term investors, we're starting to find interesting, compelling opportunities, not just within treasuries, but within munis. We're not tactically going full overweight duration, saying the peak in yields is in. There's still a lot of risk, but that's where we're starting to find opportunities at the margin.
I was almost going to give Cameron sort of like her introductory drum roll, because she's in good company, isn't she? She's got Whaley from BlackRock. She's got Alliance alongside you. So what goes through my mind, and I'm going to slightly combat you there, which is, isn't it just fear of being left behind that you've got to pivot on your duration call?
Certainly. Of course, we don't want to be too cute with it, with the timing, but we're long-term investors. And if you think of it just in terms of asset liability matching and thinking about strategic allocation.
So if I said to you then, you're shifting, is it a dramatic shift in your taking of duration, or is it incremental, Manus? In other words, we see an opportunity and we add incrementally.
It's incremental because tactically we have not made this call that we say we've seen a peak in yields.
Fine.
We still see this supply and demand issue where we do know we have higher deficits and that is increasing supply at the same time that demand is falling. QE is not here to save the day. We don't have the flight to safety bid yet. We'll have to see how data emerges. And we shouldn't forget, we have this big unknown about the Bank of Japan and potential changes to yield curve control policy. What could that mean for demand for treasuries as we go into 24?
Do you think that that could have been underpinning some of the wild moves over the past couple of days?
You can track the ownership of treasuries by Japan, and it's actually gone up slightly. They've sold more corporate bonds, so I don't know if that's necessarily, but it is the fear that they could be less buyers on the margin.
Just I'm wondering though, just going forward, when you talk about how you are legging in just on the margin to duration, is it out of equity risk? Because we heard this yesterday from Katie Nixon.
Yeah, you have to do it in a very tax efficient way, because if you're selling equities with big gains and layering into bonds, that may not be the best trade. One of the ways that we've been doing it is saying if we have dividend income, instead of reinvesting into equities, we'll reinvest into fixed income, because at the end of the day, if you can get your same return at less risk, then maybe you should do that. Now, how unrisky is long bonds given the fact that the TLT is down 45% in the last 2 years?
Listen, you know what? When you get to my juncture, you sort of say, you know what? 10-year paper actually doesn't look too bad, maybe at 5%.
Well, that's what a lot of people seem to say. Basically, it got 5%. The markets basically said, we reject that. No, you know, we're going to pounce on that.
But it comes, actually, you're back into sort of general historical norms, if I'm not wrong. I mean, you know, we are, many people out there are flummoxed by rates at 5%, paranoid at the risk of 5.5%. The reality is, when I took my first mortgage in 1994, it was at 7% in the United Kingdom. I have lived through 7% and 15%. So for me,
okay,
it was free money at zero. Now I'm choking at 8.
I've got to be honest, these conversations, when people say this kind of stuff, they kind of bug me a little bit.
Why?
No offense, but just because the world was so different then. Prices were different. They were more adjusted to a 7% rate. How much do the prices of assets change the scenario when you have high prices that were backed by low rates, and then all of a sudden you've got to deal with the rate going back to where it used to be?
Yeah, you were able to see house prices go up 20% coming out of the pandemic shutdown,
yep,
simply because the average mortgage rate did not reflect that, because mortgage rates were falling so much, or the average cost of paying for that mortgage. So now, when you add very high prices to very low interest rates, that's where it becomes simply unaffordable.
Torpedoed.
No, you can come back at me next time, because honestly, you are correct, and I think that it's a valid point, but so many people have come on here and said,
it's really
you weren't around. Well, you weren't around, but I remember I took out a mortgage. It's like, well, you know, come on, it's a little bit of a different scenario. Paul Jacobson, CFO of General Motors, joining us now. You did report earnings earlier this morning. You beat estimates, but you withdrew your $14 billion profit forecast because of the uncertainty due to these strikes. Do you think that it will materially affect the outlook given the contours of where negotiations are right now of 23 to 30% increase?
Well, good morning, Lisa, and thanks for having me. You know, just before I start, I'd like to just give a big thank you to the entire GM team for an outstanding quarter across the board, including the employees that are working every day and producing the high-quality vehicles that our customers love. It's a strong testament to everything that we're going through right now. You know, when we made the decision to withdraw the guidance, it was really based on not wanting to speculate on the length or scope of the strike. You know, clearly this has been a very different UAW leadership strategy, and one that we've adapted to. But at the same time, given that we don't want to speculate where the next plant might be or how long that might be out, we thought the prudent thing to do was to withdraw guidance, despite the fact that the underlying business was actually performing at the top end of our range prior to this. So we'll provide an update with investors as soon as it's over, but we're still focused on making sure that we execute every day.
Can GM make a profit with a 25% raise for the UAW, like Sean Fain has requested?
You know, what we need to do is obviously strike a balance. We've said from the beginning that we really want to reward our people for the quality work that they're doing at each and every plant, each and every day. And that's a testament to the demand that we've created for the vehicles that we're producing, which I think is the best portfolio in GM's history. So what we've also got to do is make sure that we sign an agreement that allows us to compete in the global marketplace. When we look at the pressures and the challenges on EV profitability as well as some of our foreign competitors, we've got to make sure we can continue to price our vehicles and produce our vehicles profitably, which gives us the cash to be able to invest in the next generation, not only the models, but the plant refurbishments and the transformations that we have to do. So we've got to be able to strike that balance of rewarding our people, but making sure that we're absolutely able to invest in our future.
Does 25% allow you to strike that balance?
You know, I think it does. We're not going to sign a deal that doesn't allow us to be competitive. You know, there are obviously challenges that the team's responded to over the last few years, whether it be COVID or the semiconductor shortage or supply chain issues. The team's been remarkably resilient, and I think this is another challenge, but one that we can rise to, and I believe that we can still hit our goals.
Paul, very good morning to you. You've withdrawn the guidance. We've cleared that away. I'm curious to know, if you're withdrawing guidance, is there any risk to anything to do with dividend? Any guidance on that? Obviously, dividend and buybacks were reinstated just last year after a two-year hiatus. So is there any quirk there?
Well, Manus, I would say that, you know, our balance sheet is incredibly strong right now with about $50 billion in total liquidity available to us. We went out and we got an additional line of credit about a month ago to make sure we're prepared, because while the uncertainty and while the team is working at the bargaining table in order to try to find a deal, we've got to make sure that the business continues to run. We make the investments we can. We fulfill the commitment we've made to our shareholders, and we continue to do business as usual the best we can, and the strong balance sheet's going to enable us to do that.
As I was sort of getting more familiar with the dynamics of this strike, I've just landed in this country after 5 years somewhere else. The question that goes through my mind, to close these strike deals and to deliver on pensions, it's a very British thing. I'm curious, do you have a number that you will have to contribute to the defined pension? This is one of the most contentious parts of the negotiations, as I understand. So is there a number that you're going to have to make good on restitution to the pension to make this deal good?
Well, our defined benefit plan, which has been frozen for quite some time, is actually funded very, very strongly right now, and we feel good about that. You know, the participants participate in a defined contribution plan where, under the current agreement, we contribute 6.4% before an employee has contributed anything. So there's a good balance across the retirement plans, and we think one that's very favorable and one that you know, we've been able to adjust the business to make sure that we can put into the calculus going forward. So anything that we do to retirement goes into that bucket of what I would what I said earlier, which is we need to be able to compete in the global marketplace. And you know, where we spend our money isn't necessarily as important as how we spend it. So we're really trying to strike the balance as to what's important with the UAW.
If you had Elon Musk in front of you now and you were talking about prices, I bet you wouldn't be having a nice conversation. I mean, how brutal have his price cuts been for your plans for 2024 in EV?
Well, when you look at what our average transaction prices have done this year, they've actually been remarkably stable in the midst of it. Now, that's primarily the internal combustion engine portfolio, which I would say is not necessarily a direct competitor with EVs, although EVs do work to try to disrupt ICE vehicles as much as they can. So it's one that we've been really competitive. When you look at our EV slate, we've kept our pricing very stable, and while we're delivering in smaller quantities than some of our competitors, we are expanding rapidly. We have a strong order book that we're fulfilling, and customers have stuck with us through this. So in the third quarter, we produced about 2x the number of Ultium platform vehicles as we did in the second quarter. So we're growing rapidly, and pricing has been very stable for us and our products, and our customers have stayed with it.
Paul, do you think that the prices of vehicles are going to go up because of the strikes?
Well, you know, we've seen some tension, and obviously when you look at the inventory levels, there's a little bit of challenge. We saw some increases in the used car market in particular leading up to the labor stoppage. So we're watching that closely. Obviously the consumer has seen a lot of pressure on monthly payments as a result of higher interest rates over the last couple of years, but that's something that we strike a strong balance with. But it all starts with having strong demand for your portfolio of vehicles, and right now GM's got a very, very good demand book.
How much is demand starting to wane, though, especially you talk about taking out loans and how much interest rates have gone up, and we've seen that subprime auto loans are seeing delinquencies at rates that are unprecedented in data going back to the early 1990s. How much is that impacting? How much do you expect demand to grow going forward?
We really haven't seen much of an impact, Lisa, on that demand. It's been pretty consistent. So when you look at our average transaction prices, they're actually up year over year. Wholesale volumes were up about 2% in the third quarter. They've been up about 8% year to date. And inventory hasn't built. So we're moving the vehicles that we're producing, despite the fact that that monthly payments have gone up and prices have gone up. So I think that's a strong testament to the products that we have. We've obviously got to watch that and make sure that we're running the business to be resilient, and that's one of the things that we have to strike in the labor negotiations, is we've got to strike that balance of making sure that we're rewarding our people while balancing the need to compete in the global marketplace.
Just real quick here, Paul, can the U.S. truly compete with China when it comes to EV production, when it comes to EV sales?
Well, I think when you look at what Tesla's done, when you look at the infrastructure that we're building, not just in the battery joint ventures, but also in the raw materials, we believe we can be competitive with China. And you know, our vehicles that we've gotten out, the customers love them, and we think there's a lot more to come from the General Motors team.
Paul Jacobson, General Motors CFO, thank you so much for being with us.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
The International Energy Agency was created 50 years ago in the wake of price spikes and all sorts of geopolitical violence. Today, we're facing a similar type of moment. Joining us right now, Fadi Birol, Executive Director of the IEA. And Fadi, I want to start there. Even as you put out your report, which has a lot of really interesting projections, how is today similar to 1974?
Thank you. I mean, the main similarity is once again a major geopolitical crisis in the Middle East, and once again oil markets risk to provide a major shock with a high and volatile oil prices. Oil security is at risk, as about one-third of the global oil exports come from that region, especially for Asia. So there are some similarities between now and 50 years ago.
Fadi, good morning. Every time that there is a moment of real angst, and we are at the moment of war here, so it's not just angst, it's war between Hamas and Israel. The question is the boundaries, the risk to Iranian crude moving, the risk to the rest of the Persian Gulf from this Israel-Gaza crisis. How do you look at that right now, and what is the risk of major escalation in your view, and the risk to the oil market?
So if one or more oil, major oil producing or exporting countries are involved in this crisis, we have all the reasons to expect that the prices will go up. Not only in terms of production, export, supply cuts, but there is a major strait, the Strait of Hormuz, which is responsible about one third of the global oil transit and a major part of the global LNG, natural gas transit. We may well see substantial impacts on the oil and natural gas markets. Of course, we don't know, at least I don't know, how the geopolitical developments will go in the next days or the weeks to come, but the risk is rather high for the energy markets.
One of the narratives that is out there at the moment is that obviously you still have unilateral cuts from Saudi Arabia and from Russia. Novak has made it clear it's too soon to talk about what they would do in November. If there is a significant escalation, is that step one of an immediate release valve to the market of where Saudi and Russia may well put out some narrative in regards to their unilateral cuts or indeed act before the November meeting?
Yeah, it's a good point. In fact, when we look at the situation today, even before the crisis, this geopolitical crisis started, we had oil prices around $90. Very, very high prices compared to averages. Why we have it? For two reasons. One, global oil demand is strong, mainly as a result of the rebound in the Chinese economy after the COVID. But second, the point you mentioned, Saudi Arabia and Russia deliberately cut their oil production. And since beginning of this year, the International Energy Agency, we said, if you go in that direction, we may well see tightened oil markets, which could be a major problem for the global economy and for inflation, especially for emerging and developing countries. Now, this crisis come on top of the $90 oil prices. And the one, of course, plausible scenario here, if we see such a crisis, and if we see a deepening of this crisis as a result of some other countries being part of this geopolitical crisis there, then one possible option is the Saudi Arabia and Russia would change their production policies, and they have ample amount of spare production capacity.
Okay.
They comfort the markets there.
Can we zoom out a little bit and talk about your long-term views on what's going to happen in the energy complex? I mean, we've got this great World Energy Outlook report out today from your organization talking about, in the long term, global fossil fuel demand will peak by 2030 as we see the transition occur. Does that presume that the geopolitical tensions ease? What are the presumptions behind that peak forecast by 2030?
Now, we are an energy organization. We cannot focus what happened on geopolitical context. But the reason that we see, for example, oil, we talk about oil demand to peak in the next 5 or 6 years is the following. There is a big move on the transportation sector, which is a big chunk of the global oil consumption. Electric cars, this is when you look at the electric cars, 2 years ago, one out of 25 cars sold in the world was electric. One out of 25, 2 years ago. This year, one out of five cars sold is electric. And in 2030, with the current investment plans, current policies, every second car sold will be an electric car. In 2030. This is one, on the consumption side, it will be weaker. The second and most important one, and I'm a bit surprised that the analysts don't see this, China. China changed the energy markets in the last 10 years, and China is changing itself now. When you look at the last 10 years, more than two-thirds of the global oil demand growth came from China only. more than 2/3. And Chinese economy increased over 6% per year on average, and this was the main driver. And we all know, it's a consensus view, including the Chinese government, Chinese economy will slow down, and this will be another driver for the global oil demand peak in the next years to come.
Fatih, I only have a minute left, but this is a really important point. Are you saying that even if China has an economic boom, it is not going to increase some of the demand for oil based on the changes in that economy?
I mean, China may have a growth in their economy as a result of stimulus a year or so, but the structure, Chinese economy, when you look at the structural, the balances in the Chinese economy, the cement production, the iron steel production, the household stocks, they all come to a saturation or a decline. China wouldn't need major amount of energy, so China will be determining the next years the fate of fossil fuels, and also at the same time, of course, clean energy, as they're a champion there as well.
Fatih Birol of the International Energy Agency, thank you so much for taking the time.
Subscribe to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live every weekday starting at 7 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can watch us live on Bloomberg Television and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Thanks for listening. I'm Lisa Abramowitz, and this is Bloomberg.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.